Right.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Lechner, and I represent Ernie K. Lehman Associates of Montana and Mount Royal Joint Venture, both of which are controlled and operated by Ernest Lehman. These entities own the six mining claims at issue in this appeal. I'm going to refer to both parties collectively as Elam. The initial issue that this court must address is whether the IBLA violated the APA in the Supreme Court decision in Greenwich Collieries when it ruled that Elam had the burden of persuasion in a mining contest. After that issue, assuming that Elam had the ultimate burden of persuasion, then the three other main issues are whether the BLM presented a prima facie case against any of the mining claims, whether Elam preponderated over the BLM's purported prima facie case, and the third issue would be whether Elam was denied due process of law when the BLM unlawfully prevented him from acquiring further evidence of his discovery. With respect to the burden of persuasion issue, it's well established that a mining claim contest initiated by the government is governed by the APA. In Greenwich Collieries, the Supreme Court held that in an APA proceeding, the proponent of an order has the burden of persuasion. And then relying on Stedman, that burden is by a preponderance of the evidence. Here, the IBLA said that the government, who initiated this proceeding, only had to present a prima facie case, and then the burden of persuasion shifted Elam to overcome that case by a preponderance.
Can I ask, is the following description of the law right or wrong? It's well-settled law that the government bears the initial burden of proof to establish a prima facie case of invalidity in a claim contest. The burden then shifts to the claimant to show by a preponderance of the evidence that the claim is valid. That's what you're challenging, right? You say that's wrong?
I say that's wrong.
But isn't that what you said in the JA 264, unless I've got the wrong pleading below? This looks to me like this is your... I don't mean you personally, I don't know if you're the author, but in the statement of reasons, in your contest?
Yes.
So didn't you take exactly the position below?
But below that they argued or cited to the IBLA's boilerplate burden shifting language.
Well, you cited to the three Ninth Circuit opinions, that's what you cited there. You didn't challenge that below, did you?
Well, we did argue that the ultimate burden of persuasion should have been on the BLM because they sought to, they were seeking a forfeiture of private property rights.
If you could just help me through this. What I just read is what you're saying is wrong, but it looks to me like it's exactly what you argued, and that makes me a little confused.
Well, as Your Honor knows, I didn't write the briefs below, however, and they did use the IBLA's burden shifting language in their brief.
Why doesn't that waive this argument? If you told them this is the standard you should apply, and they applied that standard, how can we come back now and say it was wrong? I mean, your next case you can make that argument, but you can't really make it in this case, can you?
Well, the government didn't raise the waiver issue at the court below. They should have. They didn't raise it below. They just said that Foster v. Seton controlled. I think it's kind of late in the day for them to be raising waiver at the Court of Appeals, despite, in any event, even if there's a miscarriage of justice, if the law is clear that under the APA, everybody agrees the proponent of the order has...
The problem is that if you take the wrong position below, you tell them this is the burden of proof. Your position is that everything depended on the burden of proof. Well, and even if you're right, then it's your fault that we'd have to redo the whole, that they'd have to redo everything. This is not just a situation where it's just a legal question. This is a situation where your side has sort of, if you're right, set them on the wrong course, and there's nothing to be done.
Well, there wasn't. I mean, certainly wasn't any intention of sandbagging.
Of course not. I understand that, and that may be because, as the government claims, this is the rule. This is the rule that we also okayed in Foster.
Well, we submit that Foster should be reevaluated in light of the Supreme Court case and the fact that the APA clearly says the proponent of the order has the burden of persuasion. And when the government...
Appellants are not proponents in this case?
Pardon me?
You're not proponents. You don't have any property rights. You started out by asserting that you have property. You don't have any property rights. Government owns the property. You don't have any patent. That's what this is all about.
Right.
So you're the proponent. You're trying to get something.
But we're not...
Foster makes precisely good sense in these circumstances.
We wouldn't have gotten anything from this proceeding. All we would have got if we were...
You don't have anything. You're trying to get something that you don't have.
Well, that presumes all...
Government owns this property, right?
Subject to our mining claims.
Yeah, that's it. You're the proponent of your money claims. And you got to win on them. That's the whole point. The government owns the property. It's theirs. And you're trying to claim otherwise. You're trying to take something that belongs to them.
But the government wanted us to do so. By passing the 1872 mining law, they wanted to encourage exploration, development.
They had the right to do what they did. They said there's nothing here, and they owned the property when they did it. You are now a proponent of the position that, no, there's a discovery here, and we can preempt.
And I agree that would be the case.
Foster makes sense, and we can't overrule Foster if it's the law of the circuit, but it certainly makes sense on the face of it, and certainly what we've done is not inconsistent with the APA. And as Judge Garland said, you waived it.
Well,
you probably ought to go on to your second point.
Going to the merits, the question is whether the BLM presented a prima facie case. It's clear that a mineral examiner's opinion that's not based on the proper legal standards may not establish a prima facie case. The prudent man rule controls discovery, and under the prudent man rule, the question is whether there's a reasonable prospect of success in developing a paying mine. It's a two-step analysis. First, are there minerals? Well, the BLM stipulated, or the BLM's examiner, Gruber, determined that each claim contains a physical exposure of in-place mineralized rock. That's the prerequisite. We got exposures of rock containing gold and silver. Then the next question is whether the evidence of those minerals indicate there's a reasonable prospect of success. Importantly, under this step, this step does not require that the deposit be blocked out, doesn't require active mining, doesn't require guaranteed success, doesn't require an exposure of cutoff grade, doesn't require a feasibility study, nor does it require a certain rate of return. Instead, the prudent man rule recognizes that there's a possibility that there could be a failure and the mine won't be successful. But that's why they established that rule back in 1894 to encourage their exploration and development.
But the prudent man rule does not mean a mere possibility of success is good enough.
A reasonable prospect.
Yeah.
But that's the test. We overcame the test, but the BLM's mineral examiner, Gruber, didn't even apply that test. He started his test by looking for reserves. And reserves are defined as being economically extracted. It's guaranteed success. So he looked at he high graded the deposits and started looking for reserves. And then he found about 400 tons of reserves and called these valuable mineral deposits. Well, that's more than required by the prudent man rule. He did this under Circular 831, which we briefed and said that wasn't the proper standard. Doesn't even mention the prudent man rule, the mining law, and it violates their own handbook. But then once he found his reserves, well, by only looking at the reserves, he basically high-graded the deposit. He allowed him to avoid using principles of geological inference. He failed to apply the group claim rule and essentially designed an imprudent mine model that would only last 1 year that no reasonable miner would even begin to use. Then, once he found his reserves, he then determined his cutoff grade and went back to his reserves. And for those claims that contained reserves with an exposure of his cutoff grade, he determined were valuable. And doing that, he found that eight claims
were... just on effects, when they're talking about exposure of a cutoff grade, in other words, they actually have to see the mineral of that grade, that's what he was insisting on?
See or sample assay.
Yes, in other words, it has to come out.
Right.
That was the test.
Of that grade, a rock sample of that grade to qualify as a valuable discovery, a valuable mineral deposit. Using that test, he did find that eight claims were valid. He didn't analyze why the other six claims were invalid. And therefore, since he used the improper analysis, he didn't apply the prudent man rule or any other interpretation of the mining law. He basically...
The agency did not use the cutoff grade as conclusive.
No.
All right, so you keep suggesting that he impermissibly used cutoff grade as if that was dispositive of the case. It wasn't. The agency said it was not.
Right. They rejected his use of cutoff grade.
All right.
Well, then you look at the EB6 and the RE2 claims. On those claims, Gruber found and drew on his map valuable mineral deposits. Yet, because there wasn't an alleged exposure of cutoff grade, they were invalid. And in the IBLA, even though they threw out his cutoff grade analysis, when they looked at those two claims, they basically said, well, you didn't have a high enough exposure. They looked at the drill hole TCE2, which went down allegedly below Gruber's deposit and had high-grade samples or cutoff-grade samples, and they said, well, you missed it. You didn't drill through that deposit. The IBLA never looked at drill hole TCE1, which went right through Gruber's, the deposit he had plotted on the map, and exposed it. Granted, those exposures were lower than his cutoff grade, but they were exposures nevertheless. And when the IBLA threw out the cutoff grade...
I mean, your granted is the key point.
Pardon me?
The granted is one of the key points. It was below... He said that these were subsurface minerals, and there was no suggestion that what was well below would have met the prudent man rule.
He was talking about...
The EB6 and the RE2 samples did expose subsurface minerals, but they didn't otherwise demonstrate valuable deposits.
But Gruber already drew the deposit, and the question was whether we had an exposure. They threw out the cutoff grade requirement for exposure, so they're saying any exposure would do. Granted, we think we got it with TCE2, but that was the deeper of the drill holes. TCE1 went right through Gruber's 30-foot deposit. They drilled right through his deposit. To say that they didn't expose his deposit that he plotted on the map is almost unbelievable. The fact that he found reserves in that deposit, 276 tons of reserves, which means they can be profitably extracted. And we have a drill hole plus a surface sample from that deposit. And he used that surface sample to determine the grade of the deposit. Now, you can't use the surface sample to determine the grade and then throw it out and say, well, you never found the deposit. When he plotted those deposits on this map, we submit that was valuable discovery. I don't think the evidence is going to get any better than when the BLM Zone Mineral Examiner plots deposits containing valuable minerals. I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Justin Pideaux. I represent the United States in this matter. This case involves six mineral claims that are located on the Sweetgrass Hills of Montana, and the Department of the Interior determined in 1993 that those hills should be withdrawn from mineral location in order to protect environmental and cultural values, which means that prior to that withdrawal, a claim in order to be valid must already have there must already be a discovery of a valuable mineral deposit. I had intended to start this morning talking about the burden of proof issue, but given the questions from the court, it seemed that that may not be the best use of my time. So unless there,
what about your opponent's point that you didn't attack use the waiver argument in the district court?
That's true, Your Honor. We didn't attack the we didn't raise the waiver argument for the district court. I would suggest that there's some difference between this court has held in the past that a failure to raise an issue in a district court does not necessarily mean that the issue can't be raised for the Court of Appeals. I do think that's a waiver of a different in kind than inviting an error in an agency administrative process. The statute does require, the regulations, the IBLA's regulations require that only issues that are raised to the IBLA can it has to be raised before the ALJ in order to be raised before the IBLA. So there's an issue of exhaustion requirement by regulation during the administrative process. And where appellant failed to meet that regulatory requirement, I do think that confines this court's jurisdiction in a way that our failure to raise the issue before the district court does not. In any case, as Judge Edwards suggested in his questions, we view the Foster case as being correctly decided. The issue here is that Elam has staked claims to public lands, asserting a superior right of title to that possessed by the United States, and the Bureau of Land Management and the Department of the Interior has a statutory obligation to ensure that that claim is valid. This process is the process by which that claim is tested for validity. And so the underlying order, or in a sense, is the initial claim, the claim that was staked to federal land, not the self-initiated claim. The department doesn't go out and examine to determine whether or not at the time the claim is staked that the claimant is has made a discovery already.
On the RE2 and EB6, my understanding was the findings with that whatever was there was low grade and did not expose a vein or load. Is that right? Would you give me the government's analysis on that?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think if in the Collard decision by the IBLA, the IBLA says the fact that you've identified something as reserves or this or the other thing, that's not really the essential point for discovery. In order to make a discovery, you have to have exposed mineral on a claim that evidences a deposit. So the fact that on looking at data from other claims, the mineral examiner thought that he could extrapolate a mineral deposit that crossed EB6 and RE2 is not in itself sufficient to prove discovery. Now, when the drill holes were supposedly pierced these inferred deposits were conducted, what was revealed was that the inference that the mineral examiner had had made turned out not really to be true. I mean, he inferred that the deposit in that area would be, on the order of 1,000 parts per billion, and the evidence came up with much lower grades of gold, not in the band at which he had inferred a deposit. And as a result, I think the IBLA properly concluded that the evidence in the record did not support a geologic inference. Now, the IBLA has held that there needs to be a factual predicate in order for a geologic inference to be appropriate. And so the proper standard of review here is a substantial evidence standard of review.
Does that mean that the government's expert made a mistake and shouldn't have submitted? Why can't they rely on the government's expert?
I think it's important to consider what the government's expert was doing. The government's expert was assessing a suite of 14 mineral deposits, using all the data that's available and trying to determine whether or not there was a discovery. In fact, the government's expert's report was very favorable to claimants. 8 of the claims, more than half of the claims, were held to be valid. But the simple fact that the government's expert used geologic inference to try to predict these deposits in order to inform his economic analysis, which was really relevant to those other 8 claims where there are substantial deposits, in no way shows that there has been a mineral deposit. Now, what the IBLA did, the IBLA said, we're going to look at the facts that that the government's examiner testified to. So the IBLA's decision is not so much based on the report. Obviously, it considered the report, but it was also based on all of the testimony that Mr. Gruber provided. And on that score, Mr. Gruber testified extensively to the specific data that was unveiled about, that was available about these various claims.
Say something about the group claim issue. You seem to rely a lot on Forsyth 1 when there's a Forsyth 2. What is the government's position about group claims?
The government's position is, and I think the IBLA has suggested this pretty strongly, that the group claim rule, the so-called group claim rule, comes into effect once you have identified deposits on various claims, and the question is whether or not those deposits can be profitably extracted. And so it is not here. ELIM is relying
on... When you say deposits, what do you mean by deposits?
That there is sufficient evidence, sufficient geologic evidence, that you can, with reasonable certainty, predict that there is a sort of a consistent amount of mineral, in this case gold, across an area of land. Under the Fieser case...
Mineral without regard to whether it's a prudent man would mine it or not?
I think that's right. The value...
Regardless of the grade of the mineral.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that it is entirely regardless. I think that what the Fieser case requires in order to use geologic inference is that there has to be a consistency to the values, and that they have to be reasonably high. Now, that doesn't mean that they have to be profitable, they have to be unprofitable. I mean, sort of, you look at the values and you say, if we had, if their evidence showed that all of the evidence on, they had 3 drill holes that were reasonably close together, and they all showed a 500 parts per billion deposit consistently, that might be a ground for geologic inference that if that was in a particular geologic formation, that geologic formation generally had a 500 part per billion value.
What does the group claim give the proponent that a non-group claim doesn't give?
So imagine that circumstance where we had 4 claims, for instance, each of which had a deposit that was predicted to be 600 parts per billion in value. And at that point, the issue in order to determine whether that deposit was valuable would be whether or not it could be extracted, marketed, whether sort of the costs would justify extracting that deposit. Now, this is discussed in the Schlosser case. Now, in such a circumstance, it may be that it would be cost inefficient to only mine each claim individually, and that if you structured your cost analysis such that you were mining each claim individually, the project would look unprofitable. However, if you did one large mine for all of the, if you considered economies of scale, in other words, then that could in fact be a profitable mine. And so economies of scale can be considered at the stage of profitability. And I think Schlosser in many ways is a good example of this. In Schlosser, there was no question that these various claims that were at stake had mineral deposits, extensive mineral deposits, and the only question was whether or not those mineral deposits could be extracted and marketed at a profit, whether there was a reasonable likelihood for that to occur. And so in that circumstance, the board said you can look at economies of scale to determine or to predict that one operation encompassing all of these claims would be sufficient. Here, however, ELIM hasn't made the board found that ELIM hadn't made that first prerequisite step of proving that there was a deposit on these various claims, and the reason for that is that the evidence is simply too spotty. There's no consistency. You have, a 1,000 parts per billion sample that's bracketed by samples that are of undetectable amounts. And so as a result of that, the board said the factual prerequisite for making geologic inferences about whether or not there are deposits on these claims simply hadn't been met.
What about his argument about RE2, that 75 feet away there were samples that indicated a valuable deposit?
I think the problem there is that you're sort of, he's trying to bootstrap an isolated sample onto an inference that was made by the examiner. And let me explain why that doesn't make sense. The mineral examiner looked at a bunch of data from other claims that showed that there was a band of mineralization at a certain elevation. And he said, well, from that evidence, I think I can predict that there would also be a similar deposit at the same elevation somewhere else. Sort of the same strata of rock will have similar similar ore values. However, on RET, what we ended up finding was, or what the evidence shows, is that that elevation, that band of rock, didn't contain those values. There happened to be a value that was well below that. Now, the fact that there's an isolated bit of mineral well below sort of the strata that was being considered by the mineral examiner doesn't suggest that there's any continuity between that lower elevation sample and the samples on the other claims, such that you can actually infer that there's a continuous mineralization. The continuous mineralization was a mineralization that was in a narrow band of rock. And so when on this claim you find that there's something that's not in that band, the board found there was no ability to infer that the band sort of extended straight and then took a dramatic turn down and suddenly appeared, 50 or 80 feet lower in elevation on this other claim. And I think that's clearly correct. I mean, geologic inference, the idea behind geologic inference is that when you have geologic information that suggests that that a deposit with good, with high quality and consistent ore values extends over a certain extent, you can infer that to be the case. But as a matter of logic, the fact that you have that evidence to suggest a body of ore sort of at one height doesn't connect to the fact that there's a bit of mineral lower down. I also think it's worth noting with the TCE drill holes, Gruber did a sort of a back of the hand economic analysis just looking at the evidence from that drill hole to sort of say, well, does this drill hole come even close to being something that suggests mineral that could be valuably withdrawn? And he determined that the cost of gold would have to be somewhere over $1,000 an ounce, which at the time was sort of unimaginable. Today is a different story, but we have to sort of ground this in the determination that was made by the board and by at the time of the withdrawal. The only other thing I would note is the appellants repeatedly assert that the board is somehow requiring them to demonstrate certainty with respect to their mining plan. At the same time, appellants note that certainty is impossible until after a mine has been fully developed and you know what the costs are and you know where the price of gold goes and whatnot. And I think that second statement is clearly right, and the board isn't requiring any form of certainty. They're requiring reasonable estimates, reasonable predictions. For instance, with respect to the reserve argument that appellants made a few moments ago, the fact that under Circular 831, something is classified as quote reserves only means that if the deposit that has been estimated to exist in fact exists, then that deposit could be economically mined, assuming the price of gold doesn't change and assuming that cost remains the same. There's a lot of assumptions that are built into that, and so even when something is classified as reserves, it doesn't really tell us whether or not a mine is certainly going to be successful or unsuccessful, because it could be that the geologic reality departs from the geologic expectation. Unless there are further questions.
All right, thank you.
The court, thank you.
How much time does Mr. Lucker have? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
We don't dispute that the government has a duty to recognize valid, invalid claims, but it also needs to recognize the valid claims, and that's not what happened here. They talk about how these deposits on EB-6 and RE-2 are inferred. They're not inferred when he draws them on the map and calls them reserves. He found that the two bracketing claims around EB-6 were valid based on the same deposit that's on EB-6. EB-6 deposit is 10 foot wide. You can't say that those are inferred. And the government also suggests that, well, Gruber plotted his deposits and then Elam went out and looked for them with its drill holes. That's not the case. Elam drilled first. Based on Elam's sample, Gruber determined that these were deposits containing reserves. Therefore, they're valuable mineral deposits under the mining law. The group claim rule, government mentioned Collard. The lead opinion Collard was basically reincorporating the independent mine rule that had been rejected by Schlosser. So we don't think Collard's any good. Fieser case, which came up with this geological inference idea that the government's using, talked about high and relatively consistent. Fieser was a sedimentary deposit. It was a bedded deposit. Here we're talking about igneous and metamorphic structures. We're not going to have high and relatively consistent. We have a low-grade disseminated gold deposit. You're going to have low-grade, high-grade, and that's why Mr. Lehman analyzed all the samples, because you're not going to have a uniform bedded deposit. Also, when Gruber failed to apply the group claim rule, we didn't look at the patented claims. RE2, those samples that you were talking about, they were 75 feet away from his they call it inferred, but it's an ore deposit. Those samples would have been mined if they hadn't put their pit slope in the deposit when they calculated the reserves from that.
I'm sorry, sir, you have to say something.
Those deposits probably would have been mined if Gruber hadn't put his pit slope in his reserve base. By putting your pit slope, you taken out of the reserve, and they miscalculated the reserves from that deposit by 51,000 tons. Moreover, he plotted the deposit with the sample of 692, the grade sample 692. He plotted that sample in his deposit. That was this exposure that under the IBLA's rule we needed to show. They keep saying, well, it's low grade. Well, with the RE2, RE1, he said those are napkin calculations. We don't submit that's prudent by calculating quickie calculations. He didn't look at those. If you look at the JA56, where Gruber drew his reserve bases and things, and you look at RE2 and RE1, he called most of that stuff undiscovered when you have hundreds of feet of trench samples.
Did I mishear you? Did you say Schlosser?
Schlosser
overcomes Collard?
No, Schlosser established what the IBLA had been trying to do, and that is go with the group claim rule.
Collard is the later case.
Collard's later case, and now they're cutting it back. If you read the lead opinion in Collard, it was a fragmented decision. But the lead opinion in Collard basically went back to the independent mine rule by saying that there had to be a valuable discovery on each individual claim, and they're sort of gutting the ruling in Schlosser, so that's why I wouldn't follow the lead opinion in Collard. Anyways, the napkin calculations on RE1.
Could you wind it up, please, because you're over your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.